I wonder if you have ever carefully observed children's behavior in a group. I recall when our kids went to school, they went to Traverse Bay Christian School. It was a new school that had just started. Actually, Emily was in the kindergarten class, and there was kindergarten and first and second grade, and first and second were in the same class. So it was a new school. It met in our facility, made up of several churches in the area, but we had a facility that worked well for it. And I had the opportunity, because I was there, to be a lunch monitor on a regular basis. So it started off, you know, pretty small, and then each year they added another grade. And then over the process of time, there were more kids, and there were more kids to watch and observe and to see how they behave. And it didn't take long to realize they had observable differences in their behavior and responses. I'm guessing that the PowerPoint isn't working. Is that correct? Oh, it is working. Okay. All right. So my observation is that there have been a variety of responses. And most, I have found, are quite willing to conform and cooperate. And when you tell them, eat your lunch, they actually do it. And then there are some who maybe not so much. Because, you know, most of the time it's easier to just get along if you just go along with things and you can get through. I mean, sometimes there are those who want to be, you know, over the top, you know, kind of the teacher's pet kind of thing and get carried away with pleasing, but that's kind of more the exception. Then there are others who are quite resistant to conformity, to anything. You know anybody like that? They have their they have minds of their own. They resist the rules. They resist authority. Now, I didn't see so much of that at that particular school, but I did see some elements of it from time to time. But overall, you see it with some regularity. There are some who are just plain troublemakers, and they are around us. And it's not just the troublemakers, though, who have some issues. The reality is that all children have sinful hearts, and they have a bent to go their own way. They just go about it differently. So that's something to keep in mind. But there are some kids who stand out for their rebellion. I remember a kid that joined our class in fifth grade. His name was James. Don't take offense if your name is James. You may know a James who could be fitting that description, perhaps. But this particular kid, from day one, the moment he came into the classroom, was awful. Every day, constantly. I do not know how the teacher put up with it. I don't know how we put up with it. It was just awful. And every day was a problem, and this went on and on and on. And I don't remember how many years he was at the school before he finally was gone. And then we moved from Washington State to Michigan. And when I was probably is in high school at some point, there was a Christian psychiatric hospital near where my school was, but my brother was working there, and he ran into this kid. And he was now in the psychiatric hospital because he was so messed up. So it can go to that extent. So that whole story was an interesting one that I won't go into. But sometimes there are even nations that stand out as rebellious. Can you think of any nation today around us that's kind of like trouble and wants to resist everything? I don't think you have to think too hard about that. I won't mention the name, but it's right next to where the Winter Olympics are going to be taking place, so that might give you a little bit of a clue. So there are those nations, and our text today gives us some insight on recognizing such a people and nation that is rebellious. Now, we're not going to deal so much with how you handle that, because this is just working on recognizing it today. It'll come later on how to deal with that. But I would also suggest that there may be some parallels for our own time and our own nation as to a nation that goes its own way and does its own thing. So, but first, we need to have a word about the introduction of the book of Isaiah. We want to remember that Isaiah's call is found in chapter 6, where he acknowledges God's specific call to him, which is a fascinating study in and of itself, which we will get to. But the first five chapters are essentially introductory. And we want to recognize that these prophecies are not necessarily the first ones that Isaiah delivered, that what he has placed here as the introduction of the book are there for a reason. They present in a succinct way the problems that the rest of the book deals with. And so it needs to be recognized. It is introductory to get you to be thinking about what he's going to be talking about, and the things that he's dealing with are typical of Isaiah's prophecies that are to come, and they indicate what his major areas of concern are. And essentially, the introduction is there as a literary placement. It's not chronological. It's not a listing there chronologically. It's more likely to get attention and identify the concerns in a broad sense. So that's kind of the picture that you want to be thinking about. It's there to kind of set the tone for things and then connect you with why he is saying what he's saying as far as his call, and then it goes into some more detail after that. So chapters 1 through 5 introduce the whole book. Chapter 1 introduces the rest of the introduction. So you need to keep thinking about how this is laying out here. Chapter 1 introduces the rest of the introduction, which introduces the rest of the book. That's kind of the picture that you want to keep in mind. So this chapter summarizes all of Isaiah's characteristic and essential teaching. It's sort of giving you it in a condensed form, getting the overall picture. So that's what you want to think about. That's the overall picture, and it's indicating judgment from the Lord that is coming, had come in some ways already, but was ultimately coming, and it was due to their sin, which is going to be identified. And the intention of the judgment would be to purify and perfect them because God had a future for them. That's kind of the bigger picture of what is involved here. And God's indictment of his people is basically a covenant lawsuit. And we have noted before that the prophets were covenant enforcement mediators, or they were coming in as one, as an individual or individuals who were there to say, you have broken the covenant, you have broken his law, therefore you are having to deal with this in a more formalized way. This kind of lawsuit has been called a reeb oracle because the word in the original is the word reeb, R-I-B. And it's a kind of a legal description, and it also has the idea of an analogy of the lawsuit picture. And it's basically dealing with the covenant has been broken. You've broken the contract that you made with God, and therefore you are accountable for that, and this is what is going to happen. Now, the word oracle means essentially it's an authoritative divine word. We may more likely think of it in terms of the use with regard to the Sibylline Oracle or some of these things from paganism, but it had the same kind of authoritative hint to it in those pagan usages, but in the biblical usage, it was more authoritative, and it is used in some of the specific prophets. But the basic idea is it's an authoritative word from God. That's the idea. And the Reeb oracles were quite common for accountability to the covenant. And there were other places like Hosea 4, and if I can find that fairly easily, Hosea 4, verse 1, "Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. The Lord brings a charge, that is a Reeb, against the inhabitants of the land." That's the picture that's being communicated there. And so it's a form of a legal indictment regarding their covenant infraction. And you also see there are places and times where there is a calling of witnesses that may be an indicator of a Reeb oracle, where it says, as this chapter, this section of Scripture starts, "Hear, O heaven, and give ear, O earth." It's calling witnesses to say, look, see what these people are doing? It's like they are the jury that are being called on. So also, here's a quote from Kenneth Boa, Literary Forms in the Bible, from the Bible Companion Handbook online. And it says, "There is a great diversity and individuality among the prophets, ranging from the sophistication of Isaiah to the simplicity of Amos." So when you're thinking about Amos, when you think about Isaiah, think of it in contrast to Amos. Amos, you know, said he's just a simple fig farmer and herdsman, whereas Isaiah has a little more sophistication in his use of language, etc. Their personalities, backgrounds, interests, and writing styles vary widely. These writings usually take the form of collected oracles that are not always in chronological order. We've already talked about that. They utilize poetic parallelism, parables, allegories, and other figurative language, as well as covenant lawsuits, like Hosea 4 and the passage we're looking at, woe oracles, Micah 2:1-5, and salvation oracles, Jeremiah 31:1-9. So he sort of rather concisely puts all of those things together, which is part of what we're wanting to think about in terms of understanding this passage. So with all of that in view, we want to think about the cause of the lawsuit. And here we've referenced, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth," an indicator that they are being called on to essentially to be a jury to see, now look heavens and earth, pay attention to what is going on here. "For the Lord has spoken, I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider." So there's a little bit that's referenced there. But the basic idea is they have rebelled against me. These were my children that I have brought up. So the basic picture, the children have rebelled. Specific children, obviously, are in view. That's the basic violation, verses 2 and 3. "The Lord has nurtured his children from the beginning." That's part of what's communicated here. This acknowledges that God had a part in bringing them into existence as their ultimate creator, and that God has a plan for them, and he has a purpose, but he also had a promise for them through Abraham, their ultimate father, and related to the offspring that came from him. And this was planned, and it was part of his design and his intention, and there were expectations for this people. And so all along the way, when you look historically at God's dealing with this people, you see all the provisions that are there. And that included providing laws for them that would give them some parameters for their own good and for their relationship with God. Plus, he provided for them things like manna in the wilderness, etc. And he knew every detail of their 1,400-year history up to this point, as that they were a people and a nation. The Lord had a covenant relationship with these people, and that is specific, as we've referenced, with Abraham and his seed, And that was an unconditional covenant. That's basically God saying, I promise to do this, regardless of what you do. But then when they became a nation, after he redeemed them out of Israel or out of Egypt, and they became the children of Israel in more of a formal sense and became a nation, and God gave them their constitution, which is essentially the law that was given to them. It was ratified. It was a covenant with them, the Mosaic covenant. It was ratified at Sinai, and it was conditional. This was a conditional one, not an unconditional one. And so God said, I will bless you if you obey. I will curse you if you disobey. And they were obviously referred to as the children of Israel. And so it was more than just an analogy. It was part of how they were recognized and understood. They needed to recognize and remember the covenant. That's what Isaiah is bringing to their attention. They needed to think about the seriousness of the covenant, the provisions of the covenant, the extent of application of the covenant, and that it didn't stop with them even this many years down the road after they had gotten out of Egypt and got established in the land. And so then we want to think about the nature of the rebellion. They were like rebellious children. They were willfully disobeying. They not only violated God's covenant, but they also violated common decency and a good sense that they ought to have as well when they think about whose they are. So their response of rebellion is noted here in contrast to faithful service animals, the ox and the donkey. They know their master, but Israel doesn't. The common animals around them had better sense than they did, is kind of the picture that's being communicated here. So the whole nation is in view in a sense of referencing Israel, but we know that the focus that Isaiah has is on Judah, and so sometimes that term Israel is kind of an overlapping term and refers to all of them, because they all go back as children of Israel, that is, children of Jacob, who are part of the covenant that goes back to Abraham. So that's, again, part of that larger picture. They were still living under the Davidic kings at this time, whereas the northern kingdom was under judgment, and that was coming fast. And they failed to take their relationship with God as seriously as they should. And therefore, we ought to think about that. What was their basic problem? They didn't take their relationship with God seriously. What about us? Are we ever in that same boat where we're not taking our relationship with God as seriously as we should? Now, we're not the same as Israel. We're not in that same covenant relationship that they were as a nation. But we are individuals who are part of the body of Christ. We have a different kind of relationship. And we're not in a conditional contract with God through Christ, but we have a personal relationship with him through Christ. You remember Christ said, I see you as servants, I see you as friends, that's emphasizing that personal relationship. But as such, we still are under responsibility to be obedient, and we are subject to discipline as his children. So we can see there's an analogy there that has application for us as well. Then think about the next verse here, Isaiah 1:4. It says, "Alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward." Now that's getting a little bit pointed, and quite a bit is wrapped up in that. The emphasis is the nation has sinned. And just an observation here, the interjection, alas or ah, depending which version you're looking at, was a cry of mourning heard at funerals. The Hebrew word that's used here, sometimes translated woe, also as in 1 Kings 13:30. But it was generally a lament that was used. Amos 5:16 says, "Therefore the Lord God of hosts, the Lord, says this, there shall be wailing in all the streets. They shall say in all the highways, alas, alas. They shall call the farmer to mourning and the skillful lamenters to wailing." It's the idea is the judgment that is being considered, and recognizing that death is part of the judgment, going back to Genesis chapter 3. So that's part of the picture. But Isaiah is essentially lamenting Israel's present state because of the sin that Israel has engaged in. And we don't have to think too far to think about, well, what parallel is there with our nation? Again, we're not Israel, but there are some parallels that we can recognize in terms of the same attitudes, the same actions, the same responses. The prophet used three phrases to describe the sinful nation. They were a people weighed down with wickedness or iniquity. This is kind of wrongdoing with a focus on a liability for the wrong. They were held accountable for it. They were identified as offspring of evildoers, referencing a heritage that was a continuing thing. They were children characterized as causing corruption, and to corrupt was to mar or to ruin something meant for good. And then he also used three phrases to identify their behavior. They have forsaken the Lord. They're no longer following Yahweh as they could or should, which would suggest they're following something or someone else. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel, which that could also be translated, they despise or reject or spurn or feel contempt for, has the idea of a strong disrespect. And you think about, well, who are they disrespecting? The ultimate righteous God of the universe. And then you think, well, how does our nation square? If Israel, in their attitude, is referenced in this regard, where do we fit in? How do we analyze where we are if we were to compare us as a nation to the comments that are made here with Israel? And then they turned away backward, it says, the idea of being estranged or turning your back on. It's all part of the same basic idea. It's an attitude. It's a deliberate act of turning away. And there would have been likely an emotional perhaps even a physical separation in terms of their activities, but also obviously a spiritual emphasis. And it's a matter of the attitude and the thinking that is behind that. And you think about, well, what's going on in our world today, in our nation today? Is there an attitude of going along with God, going along with His Word? Or is it an attitude of, I don't even believe He exists, I don't want anything to do with Him, I don't want to hear about Him, and I don't want you to ever say anything about Him in public? That's kind of where we are in our world. And that's not unlike some of the concerns that were expressed here. Then the result of violation. The consequences of the rebellion are noted. Why should you be stricken again? That's something to note there, the again. You will revolt more and more, anticipating what is to come. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faints, from the sole of the foot even to the head. There is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment. So what we see here is a physiological analogy. And if the lawsuit analogy sounds too technical, then consider the medical analogy that's given here. Walt Kaiser says, true prophets are like good doctors. They diagnose the case, prescribe a remedy, and warn the patient what will happen if the prescription is ignored. And so there's the analogy given here of thinking about the nation as a physical body that is sick in its thinking and in its responses of the heart. And the point is that there are consequences that come. And Israel was experiencing the destructive results of her sin. And they had been manifest in different ways already, but the anticipation was that it was going to get worse and worse because their rebellion was going to continue and intensify. And again, oops, forgot it didn't shift in sections. This was not a new problem for the nation. This is again, and you look back in the history and you see time after time after time how Israel responded in a resistant, disobedient, whining, rebelling, complaining manner. Time after time, in spite of all of the incredible things they had seen God do. And so God sent prophets to tell them, you are going the wrong direction, you need to get with the program. And so what it's emphasizing here in this passage is this picture of the effects of rebellion are like a serious sickness that they had, and they weren't taking medication for it, they weren't taking treatment for it, they weren't doing any of the things that they could. And we see it's noted as comprehensive. It's from the foot to the head. So the picture is rather strong and pervasive. And so Isaiah is giving a diagnosis of them, and note, this is happening because you're sick inside, and it's a spiritual problem that you need to deal with. Then Isaiah 1, 7 to 9, your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour your land in your presence. And it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers. So the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Unless the Lord of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah. So what is this telling us? Well, this is now a geopolitical analogy. The country is desolate. Isaiah moved from describing Israel as a sick and injured body to a desolate, conquered land. And even though it wasn't formally completely conquered yet, it had been in the process of attempts to take the land, and it was going to become a desolate, conquered land in the not-too-distant future. The results of rebellion that we want to recognize here, the results of rebellion may affect physical assets, those things that you possess. It may have an impact on those things around you, your countryside, your garden, your cities, the things that you own and possess. And what we want to see is that this is really looking back to Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 to 17, because this is covenant language that's used here, where it says, and it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the country. You don't even have to go any further than that and realize that's what he's talking about here. The country is desolate. The cities are also defiled or burned or whatever. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. The production of the land will be affected as well. So this is a distinct allusion to the curses of the covenant that are noted in Deuteronomy 28. And it's noting that there is a connection between their disobedience to the covenant and the responses, the things that are coming upon them. And so there is a general expectation for a retribution or a retribution for evil. As it says in Galatians 6, 7, you reap what you sow. It's that basic principle. Now, there are exceptions in the book of Job tells us that is the case. But the general principle and the provisions of the covenant essentially are if you obey, things will go well with you. If you disobey, they won't. Always exceptions beyond that, but that's the general picture. The results of rebellion may affect their living conditions. And I didn't quite get to that point. But anyway, a couple things to note here before we wrap up with the conclusion. Looking at verse 8, so the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. And you kind of want to look at that and go, what are you talking about? What is this about? Well, the reference to daughter of Zion here may be a reference suggesting that God is feeling like a father who has concern for a wayward daughter. That may be part of the picture that is in view here. And then it's pointing out the element of vulnerability, the unsafe environment, the reference to a hut or a booth in a vineyard. It's been pointed out that many of the Israelite families lived in villages, but they would build little shelters in their fields that were outside of the village. And then they would camp there during harvest season, so they would be closer to be able to care for things. And so then these little shacks that they would stay in during the harvest time would be abandoned the rest of the time, and they would deteriorate and become less useful and more unsafe. And they are a temporary, very primitive kind of thing. And therefore, the situation for Israel was such that they were no more, it was not like being in a secure fortress. They were in just a little hut that would be more like a besieged city that anybody could take at any time. Therefore, it was not secure, is the picture. The results of rebellion may be devastating, if not for grace, is another element that's pointed out here. Isaiah, even in the beginning here in verse 9, says, unless the Lord of hosts had left to us the very small remnant, a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been made like Gomorrah. And it's an indication of grace. Even though they are going down the wrong path, yet there's this element of grace that's there. Romans 9:29 quotes this. It says, as Isaiah said before, unless the Lord of Sabbath, Lord of hosts, Lord of Sabbath, had left us a seed or a remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been made like Gomorrah. And so the remnant theme that's referenced here in the beginning, because this is sort of a summary condensation of what he's dealing with. There's this hope that is there. So that ought to be an encouragement for us as well, that there, God's grace is still in the picture. Even though there's judgment, even though there's discipline, there is still grace, and we want to recognize that. Then looking at the concluding elements here, the initial evaluation is serious. And it's pointed, very specific, even though it's a broad picture in some ways. The problem of rebellion is not isolated to Israel. You know, we're talking about Judah. Israel is the broader term, but because we know that rebellion is found in every nation, in every people. is found in the hearts of the saved as well as the unsaved. And we know that that's a reality. The specific charges that are indicated are prevalent today because we know that there is no shortage of iniquity, of evildoing, of corruption, of forsaking the Lord, of having contempt for the Lord, or turning one's back on the Lord as the list of things that he was pointing out. And so we need to ask ourselves, how would you evaluate our nation today? And you'd have to say, I think it's kind of leaning in the same direction as what Israel is being indicted for here. And then you have to ask, well, what about my own heart? Have I evaluated it? Is it expressing rebellion like the little fella up there in the picture? Or is it submissive to the Lord? We all have our moments, don't we? Are we part of the remnant who seek and follow and serve him, in spite of what the overall nation may be doing? So it's a reminder for us that we do well to evaluate our own selves, our own hearts. When we look at the indictment here of Israel, we need to always come back for a moment and say, well, how are we doing in light of that? And could Isaiah the prophet or someone else bring a similar indictment to us as a nation or to me as an individual? We need to take our relationship with the Lord seriously. That's the picture.